From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Let's start this hour with that bombshell journal article that claims a man in London is now free of HIV after getting a stem cell transplant. He's only the second person in history ever reported to have been cleared of the virus. I'm not using the word cure because the scientists who did this study aren't either. It's published today in the journal Nature, and joining us now is Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Now, first of all, this was a bone marrow transplant. The patient also had cancer. And now the scientists who did the study, and you're not one of them, just to be clear, say he is in long-term remission. Would you call it a cure?
No, I don't think you can call it a cure. And I think we have to be careful and circumspect in how we put this into perspective. The person needed a bone marrow transplant because he had an underlying neoplastic disease, Hodgkin's disease. So what happened is that they gave a transplantation from a donor who had a genetic defect that made him protected from HIV. So about 1% of the Caucasian population has a genetic profile that makes them refractory to getting infected. So when they transplanted the person who had the lymphoma, the Hodgkin's disease, with that marrow from the donor, now the person had cells that were refractory, which allowed now the virus not to be able to replicate in that person. So right now you could say the person is in remission and could possibly be cured. The only thing we have to be careful about that we don't feel that this is something that could be scalable or extrapolatable to the millions and millions of people who are infected with HIV but can easily be controlled with a single pill a day. This person needed the transplant for his cancer, whereas if you don't have a cancer, this is a very risky procedure. Anything like a bone marrow transplant with all the immunosuppression and other things that go on with that is something that's risky and certainly not scalable. So I just want to make sure we put that into perspective when we say that this is a big, important finding of a second cure now in so many years that we've been trying.
So what is the significance then of this finding? How will what just happened be used as researchers try to find a cure for HIV?
You know, what it is, years ago, a person called the Berlin patient, Timothy Brown, did have the same thing and was shown to be now free of HIV. The importance of this is more of a proof of concept. And the concept is that there's a certain receptor that people have on their cells that the virus binds to and allows itself to infect a person and replicate in a person. When they did the transplant with someone who had a genetic defect and did not have this particular receptor, it just proves that if somehow or other, in a much less dramatic and draconian way, we can modify this particular receptor that's on the cell, we may be able to then get people to be essentially refractory to further replication. But doing it with a bone marrow transplant in a lot of people is just not feasible. So it's more of a proof of concept of the mechanism as opposed to something that we could now widely utilize among the many, many HIV-infected people.
Well, and going back to what you said a moment ago, this is not scalable, but people at this point who are infected with HIV rely on a pill a day in many cases to treat it. Where are we right now in treatment of HIV in general in this country and around the world?
Yeah. Well, in general, the treatment has been spectacularly successful. And it, really, that's one of the reasons why I emphasized putting this into context. Today, in 2019, if you have an HIV-infected individual, which I take care of all the time, and you put them on a single pill that contains a combination of three drugs, in the overwhelming majority of people, you could bring down the level of virus to below detectable level, which does two important things. It saves the life of the individual and allows them to lead essentially almost a normal life with almost a normal lifespan. But importantly, it also makes it virtually impossible for that person to transmit the infection to their sexual partner. Because you suppress the virus to such a low level, the person becomes untransmittable. That has important implications for the prevention of further HIV infection. So it's really a twofer. It's good for the treatment for the individual, but it is a major impact in stopping the transmission of infection. So treatment is really, right now in our day and age, really come a very long way and is highly successful.
That is Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much.
It's good to be with you.
Now, what to make of reporter Jane Mayer's lengthy expose of the relationship between Fox News and the Trump White House, the closest we've come to having state TV, according to presidential historian Nicole Hemmer. The article included the multi-source claim that before the 2016 election, Fox killed its own reporter's story of Stormy Daniels' hush money payment. Again, this was long before the Wall Street Journal broke that story after the election. That President Trump tried to pressure the Justice Department into blocking a media merger just to spite CNN, and that Fox News CEO Roger Ailes tipped off Trump about questions in the 2015 debate. Dylan Byers is senior media reporter for NBC and MSNBC. Dylan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And look, we know that the Trump administration is cozy with Fox News. It had been reported before that Sean Hannity calls the president every night after his show. You have Bill Shine, the former Fox executive, who's now director of communications. The president recently tried to appoint a former Fox reporter, Heather Nauert, who'd been at the communications department of the State Department, tried to appoint her ambassador to the UN. Is this really new?
Well, there's a lot in this report that will be familiar to folks who have followed the relationship between the Trump administration and Fox News. And there's a lot in here that sort of falls into the category of offensive to liberal sensibility, offensive to our sort of 20th century understanding of the responsibility and the expected integrity of any organization that branded itself as news. Now, all that said, amid that, there are actually some very significant revelations here, most notably the revelation that President Trump ordered his chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, to pressure the Justice Department into blocking AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner. And so what you see in this report really is the sort of incredible return on investment that Rupert Murdoch got from creating the Fox News channel more than 20 years ago.
So in the case of the AT&T Time Warner potential merger, CNN would have been involved in that. It was said that Trump was trying to, you know, spite CNN. Meanwhile, shortly after, there was a merger that involved Fox that sailed through. But, you know, this falls into, we start falling into the, you know, people thought that Trump had had a hand in this. Is there any criminal result or legal action because maybe we have more proof that he did?
Well, so the reporting here from Jane Mayer about Trump specifically ordering Gary Cohn to have the Justice Department block the AT&T takeover of Time Warner, that to me is, if not an invitation to a legal investigation, it is an invitation to an investigation by Democratic lawmakers. We can't ignore the context in which this Jane Mayer report happens. It happens right on the heels of Democrats finally having some leverage in Congress. Now, you know, Mayer's report is based off of one well-placed source. That alone is not, grounds for anything other than a Democratic investigation. But a Democratic investigation into an attempt to sort of influence regulation of mergers and acquisitions could be quite significant. And I think it gives the Democrats more fodder for those investigations.
Well, what about her reporting that Fox killed its own reporter story about the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels? This was in the run-up to the election. And according to Mayer's reporting, this reporter went to several editors and one said to her something like, good reporting, kiddo, but Rupert Murdoch wants Trump to win, so we're shelving it. And she tried to get it aired again after the Wall Street Journal, after the election, came out with its reporting and couldn't. I mean, hiding a story.
Right. And so this to me is there's some gray area here. It is offensive. It is arguably unethical. It's arguably immoral. Does it become a legal matter? I think it's a little bit more difficult to get that one through.
Well, and the same probably applies to her reporting that Roger Ailes tipped off candidate Trump about Megyn Kelly's debate question about Trump's history of making disparaging remarks about women. A lot of people thought he came back awfully quickly with that line about Rosie O'Donnell. This reporting may explain it. But as you say, Dylan Byers, it's offensive. But recent polling showed that 99% of CNN viewers believe President Trump has been lying about the Russia investigation, and just 12% of Fox viewers thought the president had lied.
This is the story of our time. There is a balkanization of the media, and we are living in separate silos now as Americans, based off of the news that we choose to consume, based off of the sources that now reinforce our own worldview. And in the case of the Fox News viewers, they are getting a lot of misinformation.
Well, and we just got to look inside the silo. Dylan Byers, senior media reporter for NBC and MSNBC, thank you.
Thank you.
You can't say Benjamin Dreyer is just a copy editor. You can't say that because he's so much more. He's vice president, executive managing editor, and copy chief of Random House. But you also can't say it because just as a copy editor, just as in merely, is one of the words Benjamin Dreyer says, throw away, don't use it, and you will be a better writer. He should know he's dedicated his life to making others better writers. In that ballet, or sometimes sword fight, copy editors have with the authors they're editing. As actress Zoe Caldwell once told him conspiratorially, copy editors are like priests safeguarding their faith. In which case, Benjamin Dreyer has now written a new Bible, Dreyer's English and Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. And Benjamin Dreyer joins us from NPR's New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I have to confess, I'm a little scared. I'm going to say something like, more importantly, my mother always said it's more important, there's no Lee, and all hell's going to break loose here. Do you have people say that to you, like they're almost afraid of talking to you?
People do say that, and of course they say it partly as a joke, but of course they're partly deadly serious.
Well, but okay, how about our introduction? A little overwritten?
Personally, in that I was the object of it, I thought it was charming.
Okay, great. Goodbye. I'm on a roll. Well, let's talk about some of those words that you say. Don't use them for a week. And we can understand these are words that modify other words. So very, rather, just. And I can understand a word that's being modified should be good enough to stand on its own 2 feet. But why just?
Because there are so many other more interesting ways to say simply or merely or solely. And just is just so bland.
We want more tips like that one. But before a lightning round, you only work with one author now, Elizabeth Strout, except for her first, Olive Kitteridge.
Yes. Burgess Boys and My Name is Lucy Barton and Anything is Possible, and very exciting to admirers of Liz's Olive, Again.
Yes, The Return.
Which is spectacular.
Well, what's that like? I mean, you're the shadow. You're off stage applauding the author, but you're in this mix with them.
Well, it's become such a great time between her and me because there's a level of intimacy that has developed between the two of us. And I feel sometimes that I'm in her brain. She's in mine, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has said to me that sometimes she's working on something in a manuscript and the sentence is a little sort of naughty and she can't quite figure out what's going on. And she says, oh, well, Benjamin will fix it.
Well, what a compliment. And sometimes it is, as you describe, a waltz, this dance that you do, sometimes a violent tango. What happens when you move beyond commas or rearrange a sentence that an author hasn't said, you know, well, Ben will figure that out, and somebody's upset?
In my experience, and the thing you're always aiming for, of course, is to not have a fight break out between the copy editor and the author. Good authors enjoy being copy edited. They're aware of the fact that nobody is ever really going to pay such attention to their work all the way down to the nuclear level as their copy editor. Now, sometimes it just goes wrong. And even the best copy editor can, on occasion, simply not understand what it is the author is trying to do, not hear it.
Well, and then you might have the exchanges that you describe in the book, the author writing sniffily in the margin, it's called style, to a criticism, and then another writing in big caps, write your own blank book.
A copy editor cannot make a bad book into a good book, but a copy editor can certainly, in a substantial, real fashion, take a good manuscript and fine-tune it and polish it and, you know, tighten the screws and make a material difference.
Okay, well, make us better writers. You say there are rules, but there are some that you don't care as much about. For instance, split infinitives, infinitive, to have, to hold, to go. You say, it's okay, split them up.
Right. I mean, the Star Trek phrase, to boldly go where no man has gone before. To boldly go, that's what we call a split infinitive. And people have had it drummed into their heads arbitrarily and with no particular thought going into it. Don't do that. To which my response is, why not do it? You want to get the adverb where you want it to be. You want it to make the best sound it possibly can.
So boldly split your infinitives.
Yes.
If it sounds good. The rule is never end a sentence with a preposition, as, at, by, for. You say, poof.
It's not always the most effective way to end a sentence. I do like to end a sentence with a nice, strong word. Because it makes a punch. But every now and then to try to undo a sentence that's going to end with a preposition by taking it and just rearranging its parts, it's going to sound stilted.
So give us an example of what's okay.
This is something I won't put up with.
Oops, with. That's a preposition, but you say you can end a sentence with. You don't have to torture yourself and others by making it, this is something with which I won't put up.
Yes.
There you go.
And we're fine.
And we're fine. Nothing's happened. You say, though, the goal is, you drove me to the dictionary a lot, but the goal is to aim for a powerful finale and not simply dribble off like an old man's unhappy micturition.
Yes.
Which I looked up and it had something to do with dribbling and old men, and so people can look that up. But one rule that you say it's okay to break surprised us. A person that instead of a person who, it doesn't always have to be who?
It doesn't always have to be. Sometimes you're not stressing the humanity of the person. You're stressing the profession. You're expressing a group of people that, you know, the teachers that are attending the conference. Now, I'm telling you straight, of course, I will more often than not reach for the word who. But as Ira Gershwin demonstrated quite handily when he wrote the song The Man That Got Away, you can refer to a person as a that, and you'll be just fine.
We've used words like preposition and split infinitive, and some people may not know what those are, but may have just a sense of what's right. So you write another sentence that you say you're on the verge of making public. I'm going to read it slowly. We need whiteboards to do a segment like this, but if listeners can jot this down. I think of the internet as a real place, as real or realer than Des Moines. Well, I looked at that and I went, wait a minute. If you drop the or realer, again, the sentence read, as real or realer than Des Moines. And if you use that old trick, you drop the or realer, you'd be left with as real than Des Moines, which tells you you need to add another as, so it would read as real as or realer than Des Moines. Now, I don't think I know what parallelism is, but it just feels right.
We do rely on our ears when we are writing, and if we are lucky enough to have a good ear, you don't necessarily need to know what parallelism means or what a subjunctive is or what a split infinitive is.
Okay, moving on. Exclamation marks. You say some writers recommend that writers should use no more than a dozen exclamation marks per book. Others insist you should use no more than a dozen exclamation points in a lifetime. Double exclamation marks. No one over the age of 10, you say, who is not actively engaged in writing a comic book should use them, in which case I want to recall all of my texts and tweets.
Now, of course, you mentioned the magic words, texts and tweets. Texting has its own language. Tweeting certainly has its own language. And when at Twitter, tweet as the Twitterers do. I can certainly understand why people who have been brought up texting, they have their own way of looking at this language that they're speaking in.
Yeah.
This language in which they are speaking.
There you go. I'm like, it must be so hard being you. Moving on to fiction, you've got great advice. Overrated words, blinking, grimacing, huffing, pausing, especially for a beat, smiling weakly, snorting, swallowing, doing anything wistfully. You go on to say, you writers are far too keen on and then, which can usually be trimmed to then or done away with, and you're also overfond of suddenly. What else would you say to fiction writers?
Cut back on the murmuring. Mm-hmm. Cut back on the whispering, the shrugging, the pointing, the considering, the nodding. The sixth time in 20 pages that somebody's shrugged, or as I like to say, shrugged their unnecessarily mentioned shoulders, because what else are you going to shrug? The sixth time that's happened is maybe four times too many.
Yeah. But here's more that you say to writers, put on permanent hiatus. The angry flaring of nostrils, the thoughtful pursing of lips, the letting out of the breath you didn't even know you were holding. What do you love, though? Is there a word you've come across lately where you just went, oh, you know?
All sorts of words appeal to me on a visceral level. They do something. They make a particular sound. At the moment, I'm trying to think of the ones that I love, and mostly I'm thinking of words that I have a visceral distaste for.
Well, let's hear some more of those while you're thinking.
I can't bear the sight or the sound of the word munch. It just makes me shiver. And I somehow have never quite been able to make my peace with the word nosh.
Oh, to nosh on something.
A word just popped into my head, incarnate. It's like, I like that word. I like that word. Occasionally I'm asked, what's your favorite word? And I always choose for my favorite oddball word, which is defenestrate. To throw something or someone out of a window.
Well,
it's so weirdly specific that it's delightful that the English language came up with it.
Yeah, but if you were trying to tell, you know, quick, somebody threw someone out of a window, you probably wouldn't yell, they defenestrated them.
Well, I would.
And confusion would reign. Benjamin Dreyer, again, his new terrific book, Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. It's really a must read. Benjamin, thanks so much. And we'd love to have you back, maybe with some listeners' questions about writing.
That would be fun.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We've talked a lot about the trouble old school retailers have had in recent years trying to compete with online companies like Amazon. But today, the retail giant Target announced its sales were up 5% overall compared with last year. And online sales for Target were up more than 30%. Joining us now is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So how did Target do this?
Well, look, I think a little context is important. You look out in the world, you see the JCPenney's and the Sears and all the retailers who are having problems in a new online environment. Target's been ahead of the game for a long time, right? Target, a long time ago, decided that it doesn't want to be a stodgy sort of discounter. It wants to attract a broader range of customers. So it has continued to do that kind of thing. It has new lines of lingerie, new sleepwear. It's really focused on kids' stuff, toys. But one of the things it's done is it's really expanded its online presence and its pickup in store. So when you look at the online sales, a large proportion of it was stuff that people ordered online and picked up in store. Or were shipped from a local store to a customer as opposed to a warehouse. So Target is really trying to take the bull by the horns and say that bricks and mortar retailers who have a lot of floor space are going to suffer in the years to come. What can they do to try and keep their customer base and grow it?
And when you hear that online sales are up 30%, is that good enough for a company like Target?
It's a lot better than people expected, let's put it that way, by a series of multiples. Overall, it only contributes a little bit to its growth, but it is important to not lose customers who would come into your stores to people who will buy online elsewhere. Now, Target's also launched something called Target Plus, which is an online marketplace where you can buy from other sellers, like on Amazon. Walmart and Amazon do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So Target is saying, can we still keep people buying from us and making some money, but passing on when you use online online sellers, you can pass on some of the expenses to them. So Target is trying to position itself to be the place you go to buy things at a lower price, or the place you go online to buy things and don't go to Amazon and don't go to Walmart. It's looking promising. The one difference is with Target Plus, you have to be invited to join as opposed to Amazon and Walmart, where any third-party seller can get on those platforms.
Now, if you go to Target, you can buy all kinds of things just like you can at Walmart. But one of the things that they sell is food. And we heard the other day that Amazon is reportedly planning to open dozens of its own grocery stores, not Whole Foods, which it owns, but its own grocery stores. How is Target doing in the food, the grocery store business?
So Target continues to grow in that space. Others have grown faster and more. So Amazon, when it wanted to grow, did do the Whole Foods acquisition. But Whole Foods and Amazon together are 4% of the country's grocery market. It's big. Walmart is 21%. So Target has a lot of space to grow. Again, this is a footprint problem because, you know, large footprint stores, when you get into the grocery business, you have to allocate a good amount of space to it. So Target is going to try and do that. Remember that the other the people with grocery stores, Kroger, Walmart, Target, the big ones, have about 10,000 stores in the United States. If we're moving to online, the growth in a lot of stores is not going to be the answer. So the issue for Target is how can it have enough groceries in its store to attract people to it while being able to move that online, because Amazon is forcing the market to go that way. Remember, we didn't all buy our groceries online, right? That was unheard of even 5 years ago.
Now everyone's doing it. Yep. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks.
Thanks, Jared.
President Trump called out House Democrats today, saying their investigation of him is the greatest overreach in the history of our country. As part of that investigation, Democrats are requesting documents from dozens of entities and people, including the president's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr. Donald Trump Jr. was at that Trump Tower meeting in 2016. He is also one of the most ardent political surrogates for his father. He spoke at the Conservative Political Action Conference over the weekend, touting low unemployment rates among minorities.
If Barack Obama accomplished one-tenth of what Donald Trump has done for those minority groups, they'd crown him emperor for life.
Joining us now is Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief at The Washington Post. Welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
So Donald Trump Jr. is executive vice president of the Trump Organization with his brother Eric, but he gets a lot of attention for statements about politics, tweets, TV interviews. How would you describe the role that he plays for the president?
You know, it's interesting. He does not work in the White House, unlike his sister Ivanka Trump, but he is the most political of the Trump offspring by far. Don Jr. is on the campaign trail. He's a surrogate. He's very much sort of in touch with Trump's base. And he likes to mix it up in politics. He loves the back and forth on Twitter. He loves to be in the fray. And that's why we saw him on stage at CPAC.
And in fact, he has had the views that he's had. And you would have to describe him as a pretty far-right conservative. He's had them since even before President Trump was in the White House.
That's right. It's interesting. If you go back to look at his sort of upbringing and what he was like as a child and as a teenager, he was always very interested in the outdoors and hunting and sort of activities that are very much the core of kind of middle America and out in rural America. And he's been a conservative ideologue for some time. You know, certainly his father has espoused conservative positions over the last few years, but Don Jr. was there first. And if you think of who is sort of authentically channeling that conservative vote, you'd have to say Don Jr. And he's more sort of at peace with that element of the Republican Party than even his father, the president.
Do you get the sense that President Trump relies on Don Jr. as sort of a window into his own base?
He does. He certainly relies on Don Jr. as a window into on issues like guns, on issues that affect rural Americans. For example, last year there was a really big competitive Senate contest in Montana, the reelection of Senator John Tester, a Democrat. President Trump was very invested in that race. He hates Tester. He very much wanted to defeat Tester. And he would turn to his son, Don Jr., for advice on how to do so, because Don had been to Montana. Montana. Don is a hunter. Don goes fishing. He loves these sort of wildlife outdoors expeditions. And he thought that Don Jr. would have a much better sort of gut sense of what the voters of Montana were thinking and actually deployed Don Jr. repeatedly for campaign rallies and a tour across the state.
Let's hear more from the CPAC conference over the weekend. Becky Falwell is the wife of Liberty University President Jerry Falwell Jr. and was talking about her new granddaughter named Reagan, as in President Reagan. Donald Trump Jr. had this to add.
I lobbied for Trump, but it was a little too soon, maybe. So we'll see.
Trump is not the most feminine name, but we could make it.
Hey, you know,
neither is Reagan.
We're
going to
take a page out of the liberal playbook. It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter. We can identify how we want.
Oh, by the way, she is a daughter. She's our granddaughter. She's a and we're raising her as a girl.
She's beautiful.
We're not letting her have a choice. She's what
there,
God
designed. There will be outrage tomorrow that you decided for
it's
her.
It's God.
He's been criticized for those comments and many others. He made a comment to a Philadelphia radio station in 2016 that if his father lied like Hillary Clinton, the media would be warming up the gas chamber. He compared Syrian refugees to Skittles candy. He compared immigrants to zoo animals. Does he take it too far sometimes, or does anybody in the White House believe that he's taking it too far?
Well, he certainly blurs the line of too far. you know, he's not somebody who sticks to a script. He's not, you know, out there like Ivanka Trump, you know, reading from very carefully prepared remarks, trying to hit just the right balance. Don Jr. is much more spontaneous. He likes to excite his crowds, and to do so, he, you know, says things that are off color, offensive, some would say even racist at times. And, you know, I think he feels like that makes him authentic. Now, if you talk to folks in the White House, they say that Don Jr. is a very effective political surrogate for the president. He's somebody who is sort of a celebrity figure within the Trump base, and they can send him out on the road to rallies and he can whip up a crowd and create some energy and excitement. There does not seem to be, you know, a lot of negative feelings about him when he gets into hot water like this, but, you know, other than a little bit of an eye rolling here or there. But, you know, he's also not a part of the government. He's not somebody who's tasked to sort of carry a message politically in Washington or you know, push for legislation to pass, for example, or do some of the kind of work that his sister Ivanka does.
And yet he may be called before Congress to testify now as the House Democrats ramp up their investigations. Let's look at that part of it. He was mentioned in Michael Cohen's testimony last week. He was at that infamous 2016 Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer promising dirt on Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
And Cohen suggested that Trump Jr. may have told his father about the meeting before it happened. Let's listen.
And I recall Don Jr. leaning over to his father and speaking in a low voice, which I could clearly hear, and saying, "The meeting is all set." And I remember Mr. Trump saying, "Okay, good. Let me know."
What are the legal issues right now with that meeting, and how does Donald Trump Jr. factor in?
Well, Trump Jr. is exposed in that meeting. He set up the meeting. He did so according to the email documents that he shared publicly that we've all now seen. He did so with the knowledge that this lawyer was, you know, providing information on behalf of Russia, and it was part of the Russian government's attempt to help his father's campaign. You know, that is not legal. It is not legal for, you know, anyone associated with an American political campaign to be conspiring with people from a foreign country. Now, you know, whether Robert Mueller writes up a bill of goods against Don Jr. in his report is to be determined. We know that Don Jr. has not been indicted as part of that investigation. But, you know, clearly there's some exposure there. And, you know, the other thing that's happening simultaneously is Congress is trying to dig in. And not just, by the way, about the Russian interference question, but there was a request from Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, this week for documentation regarding Don Jr.'s communications with his father, with the president, on any number of topics. Now, I don't know that that request will be fulfilled by the White House, in part because Don Jr. is a family member. He's not a White House employee. His communication with the president may not necessarily even be something that the White House has access to, let alone decides is, you know, within sort of legal justification for the Congress to review. That's all to be determined. But clearly, the eldest son of the president is in some jeopardy here.
And there is a suggestion by Democrats that he actually lied to Congress when he testified in 2017 about that meeting.
That's right.
Meeting.
That's correct. And I think that's one of the reasons why Nadler's committee, you know, wants more evidence pertaining to Don Jr. and very well may request that he come forward and testify. You know, I don't think Don Jr. has testified for the last time before the Congress.
What do you make of the fact, Philip Rucker, that when you look at the Twitter feeds of Don Jr. and Eric Trump, that they're quite different, that Don Jr. is much more of a, you know, pit bull for President Trump, and Eric Trump, he tweets a lot about the Trump Organization and other things.
Yeah.
I mean, he does put out political tweets, but not nearly to the same degree.
It's a really keen observation there. Don Jr. is much more comfortable, clearly, in a public political role. He likes being in the fray. Eric Trump actually spends most of his time running the Trump Organization, in particular the golf courses, which has been sort of his portfolio as part of the family company for some time. But, you know, Don does politics as an extracurricular, whereas Eric Trump, we very rarely see him in a political context. He does interviews from time to time on Fox News. He will, you know, sometimes appear at the White House for a special event, very occasionally at a rally. But it's really Don's space to be in politics.
That is Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief at The Washington Post. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's a disturbing statistic. 20 horses have died at the famed Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California since the winter racing season began in late December. That's twice the number that died in the same period last year. The latest, a 4-year-old filly named Eskin for a Drink, who was euthanized over the weekend after she injured her ankle during a race. Trainer Bob Baffert, whose horses have won every major race in the country, spoke to KABC News in Los Angeles.
We love these animals. We don't send them out there thinking something bad's going to happen, and it's stressful.
But Santa Anita will host the prestigious Breeders' Cup later this year. So what is the problem? Mick Peterson is director of the University of Kentucky Agriculture Equine Programs. He's been in California over the weekend inspecting the track. And Mick, your thoughts, 20 horses in 2 months.
Well, it's absolutely unacceptable. We're looking at every option we can to begin to understand what's happening. This is not what we do as a sport.
Well, let's talk about the track and explain what's supposed to happen. There's a certain mixture of silt and soil that has to be there. It's sort of like a pad that the horses are running on. What's it supposed to be like, and what did you find?
We're always looking at the composition of the track. We do monthly tests of the composition of the track. Samples are sent to Kentucky to the Racing Surfaces Testing Laboratory. And twice a year, we go out and do ground-penetrating radar, and so the advantage at that track of all is that we've probably got the best baseline data of almost any track in North America.
Well, and you didn't find anything wrong?
No, we didn't. We were looking at every option. One thing is when there's a lot of rain, you look and you expect the fine material to move to the inside rail of the track, and after we'd analyzed the samples under the assumption that there might have been an issue, we found that actually it was very consistent.
Well, and can you talk about, you know, how much work, you just alluded to it, but how much work it takes to maintain a professional racetrack where something, you know, you've got this mix of sand, silt, clay, you've got rain, and something as, you know, insignificant as to our eyes, like a grain of sand, could injure these, you know, 1,000-pound magnificent thoroughbreds.
Yeah, and the maintenance of the track has kind of developed over years, and what we've been doing is documenting a lot of that and putting science behind it, because everybody talks about the horses, but keep in mind there's a rider on the back of every one of those horses as well. So we're not only protecting the horses, but we have to protect the riders. So our approach to this is every year we need to be improving.
Well, you and others have called it statistical clustering, that it's just a sort of an abnormality. But, you know, people for the ethical treatment of animals are calling for the track to be closed, 20 horses dying. But then people are also becoming aware because of this story that I said last year it was half, it was 10. But then before that, between 2015 and 16, there were 14 deaths. In fact, according to data from the California Horse Racing Board, there were 553 deaths between 2008 and 18 in 10 years. That's a lot of horses dying. Is something else going on? People have talked about, have horses been bred to have thinner ankles to be faster, and is that what's causing this?
Well, what we're doing is we're looking at every possible avenue, and this is really where the California Horse Racing Board comes into play, because each of these horses will have a necropsy performed, and so California Horse Racing Board is a government agency. So that, keep in mind, that's a, they're independent, and also where people like myself, who my position at University of Kentucky allows me to say things that aren't always what they want to hear. Mm. And same for the equine medical directors in Kentucky, New York, and California. These are people who really their job is to oversee and to speak to the government oversight agencies about what they see and how to improve the sport.
What was your reaction when you first heard about the latest death of the filly?
Oh, I was devastated. I mean, you heard Bob Baffert, you know, none of us expect this, and we have to improve the way that we're maintaining the tracks, and we have to do everything we can to protect the horses, because this is not an acceptable series of events.
Well, I think what you see, your exact words were, what the hell do we do? And some would say, again, close down the tracks. But you mentioned weather. Do you think it's the recent rains? Because others are suspecting that.
Well, the rain's always a factor. And what we see in horse racing always is the challenge at any track is unusual weather. You know, so that might be a dry period at Churchill Downs or the track Fairgrounds in New Orleans is as big a challenge as rain in California. And this is really where it's got to be an industry-wide effort to both increase the knowledge of the superintendents, increase their understanding and professionalism, but also to share best practices and bring things together. And that's really where the Racing Surfaces Testing Laboratory that was formed, that's really what our job is.
And is there something to look at in breeding?
I don't have a lot of expertise, and there's other people who are looking at specifically genetic issues, and we're looking at, you know, even the use of analgesics. What I'm doing in this is I'm bringing the track information and the maintenance information to the California Horse Racing Board. Then the regulators need to step back, and for example, the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium is looking at any issues that may be need to be investigated in any kind of medications that are used.
Mick Peterson, director of the University of Kentucky Agriculture Equine Programs, part of the team that's trying to figure out why 20 horses have died in the last 2 months at the Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California. Way too many. Mick, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll follow this story. Here and Now, which is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.